This is Functional Medicine Update for May 2004, Volume 24, Number 5. In this month's issue, we'll turn our focus to designing a lifelong strategy for mental and physical well-being. We'll begin this issue with a report on the placebo effect of hope, both for patients and practitioners. And next, review the lifelong preventive cocktail. This will help us design a functional strategy for lifelong prevention. And next, we'll review glycosylation and the relationship of aged proteins and kidney function. On the second half of this recording, our subject will be the protection and repair of the brain, including the role of nutrition on gene expression and degenerative disease, plus the four interrelated factors of Parkinson's disease and aging. We'll close out this issue with an update on vitamin E, gamma tocopherol for neural protection. And now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland, the May 2004 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for May 2004, the month of our 11th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. We consider this kind of a celebratory month around the Institute for Functional Medicine halls in that it's a year in preparation and planning for our annual symposium, and certainly this year was no exception to the history over the previous 10, with the mounting excitement to put together the program with some of the world's great presenters on the topic this year, looking at the coming pandemic of insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and type 2 diabetes. A number of themes really come out of this discussion and preparation for the symposium, and it's those that I would like to kind of summarize as we move into the symposium and out into our June issue, which will prepare us for next year's symposium. I'd like to talk a little bit about the state of where we see medicine and how it interrelates with this coming pandemic of metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes as an example of a more general theme. I think it could be said that we are all looking for the hope of a new medicine to emerge, a medicine that would in fact be able to better address chronic complex health problems. We know that we have a very sophisticated disease care delivery system that at the crisis care level is quite adept in handling emergencies and life-threatening events that require high technology for their successful remediation. It's when we extend some of these procedures that were developed for high technology intervention and crisis care into the chronic care regime that we start to experience problems. Because many of the medications that were very successful in short-term use in crisis care, when extended for long-term use, the risk-benefit equation, or what might be considered the cost-benefit equation, starts drifting more towards risk and higher cost and less towards the benefit side of the equation. And so things shift with adverse drug reactions and other longer-term disabilities as a consequence of what has been called the iatrogenic effects of the treatment, or the procedure-induced problems of the treatment starting to demonstrate themselves with greater frequency. So there is a hope that we will see a medicine that's formed that is around this complex chronic disease family that will deliver some forms of therapy that will maintain their benefit with lowered risk over decades of intervention. As Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1847, you recall the great quote, he says, "The key to living a long life is to have a chronic disease and take good care of it." Meaning that you don't want something that's going to kill you, just want something that gets your attention and reminds you that you're mortal and you've got to work on your health care and you've got to practice it and you've got to do something to maintain your health span, to use the Dr. James Freeze concepts. Well, the biology of hope is a very interesting question, isn't it? Because it really interrelates with the mind-body field, this complementary medicine concept. What is the biology of hope? We often think of it as an important part of the patient's own healing process. Sometimes it's been dubbed and spoken of pejoratively as the placebo effect, that if you have hopeful and optimistic sense of outcome, that you are more likely to have a positive outcome. And from the work of Candace Pert and many others in the molecules of emotion, we've started to recognize that we can change our neurochemistry by the way we view our world and how we sense ourselves. So we often want to mobilize in our patients the biology of hope, this sense that we will create a milieu of molecules in their nervous system that will help to normalize the function of the neuroendocrine immune system and give them optimal defense against disease and reparative processes. But I would also suggest that the biology of hope is equally applicable to the practitioner. Because if, in fact, we come to work every day and our thoughts about the state of medicine and our work within it is one of despair, then we have changed our own molecules of emotion in such a way as to create a different kind of outcome, both with ourselves and our patients. I know this sounds rather preachy, and I don't want to be on the high soapbox here, but I think it's important when we start looking at neuroimmunology to recognize that that is a concept that's being applied every day in our practices with those sentient moments that are spent in the exam room with patients on that one-on-one, that really important humanistic therapeutic encounter opportunity. If we bring the biology of hope with us, it changes the dimension of our own neurochemistry and immune system versus the biology of despair about the world in which we're working. Now, I'm actually quoting from a very interesting article that appeared recently in the journal Acumen, authored by Jeremy Groopman, entitled The Biology of Hope, in which he really talks about this mind-body connection, the placebo effect. And going way back, actually, you recall, those of us who have been in this field for a while, Norman Cousins' wonderful paper that he authored in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient, in which he was talking about laughter therapy and about biology of hope and creating a healing opportunity. As you probably know, there have been all sorts of papers published since 1976 in this area. For instance, one interesting paper is looking at catechol-O-methyltransferase polymorphisms and how that relates to the production of neurotransmitters through the methylation pathway, and that the expression of this COMT enzyme can be modified on the functional status of the individual by their mood and their psychological state. So one could, with different polymorphisms, having different sensitivities to the environment, you could imagine you could upregulate methylation patterns, which would then create different symphonic orchestration of your neurochemicals that are converted one to the other by methylation, the noradrenaline-adrenaline interconversion. So I think there are some very interesting manifestations of this body-mind connection to that of biochemistry and neurochemistry and immunology. We know that there is a very significant effect in the placebo area for analgesic research or for hormonal research. It's quite fascinating, actually, from our own clinical work looking at perimenopause and menopausal symptoms. We found upward of 50% placebo effects in modifying hot flushes and night sweats in women just based on how they believe the outcome of their therapies will participate in their physiology. Similarly, if you do work on osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis pain, you'll find very large placebo effects, sometimes upward of 50%. And therefore, this is a confounder, obviously, with any kind of pharmacological intervention study that you have these large placebos. Or you might say the placebo is really a very powerful therapeutic tool, this biology of hope, this belief. And it extends from the patient to the provider and back again. In fact, in a wonderful review article that appeared in Scientific American in 1998, entitled The Placebo Effect, Dr. W.A. Brown talks about the extraordinary stratification of different kinds of patients into high placebo responders versus low placebo responders. And you wonder if those that are the high placebo responders might not, in fact, be the individuals who can mobilize the biology of hope more effectively. And I would go back again to say that this environment, the context of healing, the therapeutic encounter that is experienced between the practitioner and the patient is one that is going to be determined in part by what is the definition of that environment. Is it one of hope or is it one of despair? And we bring those kind of models, a priori assumptions and belief systems into the moment with the patient and into our lives. So how do we mobilize this very positive part of the functional medicine arsenal, the biology of hope? And then, of course, when we look at the state of medicine today, which is basically pharmacologically based, there is reason often to be a little bit despaired, because it appears as if we're pushing a model beyond the point of diminishing returns, trying to squeeze out incremental value with this pharmacological model in which every additional increment of value costs us 10 to 100 times more, either in expense to dollars or in expense to potential risk. So we get into the point of diminishing returns. And this leads, obviously, into the interesting review paper that appeared recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is the February 5th, 2004 issue. The title of the article was The Pharmaceutical Industry versus Medicaid Limits on State Initiatives to Control Prescription Drug Costs. And in this particular paper, the authors say that this escalating healthcare cost is really tied very closely to the escalating cost of medications and their increasing use. They go on to say that the healthcare system has not succeeded in controlling expenditures, and the cost pressures resulting from technological advances and with new drugs to be used by an aging population, they're likely to exacerbate the problem of access and make the system even less cost effective. And then we go about the cost and access to prescription drugs, and we start looking at how Medicaid has been hit. Spending on drugs soared from $4.8 billion in 1990 to $21 billion in 2000. So in a decade, you'll notice that that is more than a fourfold increase in expenditures to medications. And then one has to ask, at what benefit have we seen as a result of the fourfold increase of expenditures? The article goes on to talk about benefit versus cost and starting to look at this theme of diminishing returns and how state efforts are then moving to try to find ways of lowering access and using cheaper alternatives and making some of the new medications less available to patients. This is a very, very complex equation that so much ties together with demand management and how then patients are lowered in their interest in some of the new drugs versus supply management, which is to prevent the access to the medications. How do you lower demand for these products? And of course, that leads into the hope of a new medicine, a medicine that would deliver to these complex chronic disease patients that have maybe decades of living in which they're going to be required to be on a certain program. Remember Oliver Wendell Holmes, having a chronic disease and taking good care of it is the secret to a long life. So how do you take care of it? What's the least expensive way? What's the most cost-effective way? What, in fact, may be even the most efficacious way with the lowest incidence of adverse drug reactions? And, of course, when we ask that question, then we say, well, what conditions are we talking about? How about vascular insufficiencies? How about various types of cardiovascular chronic diseases? How about autoimmune diseases? How about inflammatory disorders? What about neurodegenerative disorders that are becoming ever more frequent and troublesome, the Parkinson's conditions and the Alzheimer's-like conditions and presenile dementia? What do we do about those? When you start asking those questions, it's interesting because then it brings you into saying, well, gee, well, shouldn't we also include the obesity epidemic in this? And shouldn't we include the insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and type 2 diabetes connection in it? Shouldn't we also have something related to hypertensive disorders and its relationship to cerebrovascular disease and stroke? All of these seem to be complex chronic diseases of a complex etiology, not just a single cause as a result of a single gene that's mutated, and therefore if you could answer that with a single drug that you would be able to be successful. And that leads us, of course, into the recognition that these are functional disorders that have multiple physiological inputs across multiple genes that are unique to the individual and how they interact with their unique environment and their lifestyle. And so now the question is, could you develop, at least theoretically, a preventive cocktail that would take one a week and call you back when you're 90? Is there something that could be done on the basis of the information that's been developed over the last 20 years on the etiology of complex chronic diseases that would allow us to assemble a simple, safe, and effective strategy for the reduction of risk of these major age-related chronic complex diseases? And that leads to one of the more provocative papers that I've read over the last year, which maybe you're familiar with, but in case you're not, let me tell you a little bit about it. This is a paper by Dr. N.J. Wald and M.R. Law that appeared in the British Medical Journal, volume 326, page 125, in 2003. This is a very interesting paper entitled A Strategy to Reduce Cardiovascular Disease by More Than 80%. Now, that sounds like a pretty laudable objective, right? And so you say, what treatment can you think of, surgical, radiochemical, or pharmaceutical, that could lower a major disease, in fact, in this case, the major cause of death, by 80%? And you scratch your head and turn on your cerebral powers for a while, and you say, geez, I don't know of a single treatment that could achieve that objective. Yet these authors were presumptuous enough in the title of the paper and in the body of their paper to suggest that there could be a simple strategy that could be implemented in people 55 years of age and older that would put 11 years on average of disease-free life on their life expectancy. 11 years of disease-free life. Wow, that's pretty remarkable, because we've heard that if you didn't smoke at all during your life, that on average that put about 3.5 to 4 years on your life. So 11 years, that's a pretty dramatic claim. What is this built around? Well, it's built around a preventive cocktail, right? A preventive cocktail that would contain six different agents within it that would address the six most dominant contributors to age-related complex chronic diseases. Oh, this sounds kind of interesting. I mean, we could get our arms around six things. So what is this preventive cocktail? Well, in a review paper of this article that appeared in the journal Acumen, they talk about this as a poly pill, P-O-L-Y pill, meaning it contains six ingredients. That's what Wald and Law have termed it. And that this poly pill would be successful if implemented by people 55 years of age or older on a daily basis, could contribute significantly, and when I say significantly, I mean statistically, they say more than 80% reduction of the overall factors that we now know contribute to premature death to cardiovascular disease. So what are these six different factors? Let me take you through them, because they probably would be on your list of different things. If you think about the mechanism that we now have emerged of understanding around cardiovascular disease, cancer, arthritis, what are the interrelated themes, inflammation, oxidative stress, mitochondrial uncoupling, lipid infiltration, cell signaling that relates to proliferative cells, those kind of things, as we've talked about, that are unifying mechanisms that underpin functional medicine and our principles and processes. So let me now talk about what these six things are that Wald and Law are speaking to. First of all, a statin. Because we recognize a statin will presumably handle lipid problems and will also lower arterial inflammatory process. Number two, they talk about a folic acid-containing supplement to manage the homocysteine connection, because they say that B12 and B6, although are secondarily important, and folate is by far and away the most important for managing the homocysteine connection to chronic health-related problems. So that's the second. And then three types of blood pressure modulating agents, a diazide, a beta blocker, and an ACE inhibitor. And these would be given at half dose, meaning that they would be given under the radar screen for therapy, but more prophylactic to modulate the function of these different systems, electrolyte management, angiotensin-converting enzymes, and how that interrelates then with the angiotensin-angiotensinogen interconversion with renin-aldosterone. And then lastly, the beta blocker to lower the adrenergic drive on the cardiovascular system. And then the sixth agent, because that's five I've given you, would be an antiplatelet adhesion agent, and they're suggesting low-dose aspirin or baby aspirin. So those are the six factors. Let me go through them again just to remind. And that's a statin at normal dose, a thiazide, a beta blocker, an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor at half dose, folic acid at a therapeutic dose, and lastly, an antiplatelet adhesion, baby aspirin dose. Now, if you took those six concepts just for a second and sat down and had a moment to think them through, could you design a lifestyle and diet that would accomplish similar objectives to each of those six different principles? Could you design a diet and lifestyle, for instance, that would lower serum lipids and would lower arterial inflammatory potential? Could you design a diet that would enhance folic acid intake and lower homocysteine? Could you design a diet and lifestyle that would lower blood pressure, would have a favorable effect on each of the three mechanisms of the antihypertensives that I've described, the thiazide, the beta blocker, and the ACE inhibitor? And lastly, could you design a diet and lifestyle that would lower platelet adhesiveness and thromboxane production, for instance, like essential fatty acids from the omega-3 fatty acid family, fish oils? So if you were to be given that assignment, having listened to Functional Medicine Update extensively for the past umpteen years, you probably could have, either by memory or going back and reviewing our summary cards or the CD-ROMs, you could pull up a strategy that would deliver to these six objectives. As David Deutsch talked about in his classic book, The Fabric of Reality, the future of medicine is to build on first principles predictive ability so that outcomes of therapies never before tried will be successful. That's when medicine becomes scientific, and it has a predictive, not just a historical medical taxonomy perspective. And I think that that is a really powerful example that comes out of this Wald and Law paper, to say we might be able to, in patients with individual risk in these categories, develop this, quote, poly pill or this poly program that would be even personalized to their unique needs, because not everyone has the same risk within those six categories that I've just described. So this becomes a preventive cocktail, so to speak. And if delivered, they say, effectively at people 55 years of age or older, it can add 11 disease-free years statistically to their lives. and reduced cardiovascular disease by more than 80%, knowing that it's in the last 10 years of one's life that you expend the majority of your medical services throughout your life, and that's where your morbidity and mortality become much more real and your expenditure of medical services are extraordinarily enhanced. Is that an alternative then? Does that represent an alternative to the pharmaceutical model of intervention at times when things are broken to try to fix it with ever-increasing, more expensive medications? And I think the answer is yes. By the way, those six different things that I just mentioned from a pharmaceutical side are all generic at this point and would be fairly inexpensive, even from a pharmaceutical model relative to some of the new third-generation drugs that are being sold. So I think this opens up a different strategic approach based upon mechanisms that are being developed for understanding the origin of chronic complex age-related diseases. Now let's cut from a very complex topic down to kind of a simple-minded outcome, and that is, what happens if we just got people to take a multivitamin mineral supplement every day as they got older? Would that have any benefit? You know, we didn't just assume that the diet is delivering through variety and moderation all the nutrients that they needed for optimal function of their various organ systems. What happens if they took a nutritional insurance policy or program, which would be a multivitamin, multimineral, say high potency? Well, that actually has been recently studied, and the results have been published, the so-called Stockholm Heart Epidemiology Program. It has its own acronym, as they all do, SHEEP, SHEEP. So it's the SHEEP program. I hope that this doesn't mean that we'd be following like sheep, but what the results of this particular study indicated, I think, are quite fascinating. This was a study related to multivitamin use and the risk of cardiovascular disease. They examined the association between the self-selected use of a multivitamin supplement daily and the incidence of MI in a group of individuals from 45 to 70 years of age residing in Sweden. The study included 1,296 cases, 910 men, 386 women, with a first non-fatal MI and 1,685 controls, that would be 1,143 men and 542 women, frequency match of the cases by sex, age, and hospital catchment area. The odds ratio were calculated from the unconditional logistic regression models, and among the controls, 57% of the women and 35% of the men used dietary supplements. Corresponding figures for cases were 42 and 27% respectively, so quite similar. Of those taking supplements, 80% use multivitamin preparations. So after adjustment then for major cardiovascular risk factors to kind of get those variables normalized, the odds ratio of the MI comparing regular users of supplements with non-users was about 0.79 for men and about 0.66 for women. This inverse association between increased intake of vitamin supplements and lowered incidence of cardiovascular disease was not modified by such healthy lifestyle habits as consumption of fruits and vegetables, increased intake of dietary fiber, smoking habits, and level of physical activity. So the results that we would take away from the study is it indicates that the use of a multivitamin, multimineral supplement daily may actually aid in the primary prevention of MI and be a very inexpensive first step in getting down the road towards this, quote, preventive cocktail. By the way, for those of you who want to follow up on this, this is a Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 2650 in 2003. Now, if we start looking at how this concept cuts across many different disorders that have differing ICD-9 codes associated with them, so we're talking about different diagnoses, we might ask, does this strategy also relate to things like the reduction of the risk to type 2 diabetes, or the risk to hypertensive disorders, or the risk to arthritis, or the risk to inflammatory bowel disease, or the risk to certain types of cancers? Do we see a connector that is connected by mechanism rather than by disease type? And that's obviously a very interesting question that we are going to continue to explore in Functional Medicine Update, because maybe if we can become masters of mechanisms, diseases become less important. So let's look, if we can, at a couple of papers that might illustrate the mechanism connection as being important, one of which appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association recently under the title C-reactive protein and the risk of developing hypertension. I think this is a very interesting paper, and as the editorial that follows it says, it demonstrates an interconnection between inflammation, hypertension, and metabolic syndrome, and its later connection with type 2 diabetes. These are not individual, independent disorders. They are interconnected disorders. The inflammatory connection connects to the hypertensive connection, which connects to the metabolic syndrome, which connects to the type 2 diabetes, which then connects to vascular risk and ultimately cardiovascular disease risk factors as well. In this particular paper, by the way, which appeared in volume 290, page 2945 of the JAMA in 2003, they go on to show that in a prospective cohort study that began in 1992, looking at 20,525 female U.S. health professionals aged 45 years or older, and they examined their blood pressure. By the way, this is Dr. Paul Ridker and his colleagues, once again, who have been so actively involved the last several years in the inflammation connection to a variety of different chronic health problems. What they did is they looked at C-reactive protein and found it to be, this is high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, and found it to be significantly associated with an increased risk of developing hypertension in all pre-specified subgroups evaluated, including those with very low levels of baseline blood pressure. So it suggests that inflammation has something to do with the etiology and maybe even the cause of increased blood pressure. So they go on to conclude that C-reactive protein levels are associated with future development of hypertension, suggesting that hypertension is in part an inflammatory disorder. And that connects it over to metabolic syndrome and to atherogenesis, or the origin of atherosclerosis, as is evidenced in the editorial that follows. It's authored by Dr. Scott Grundy, a well-known investigator at the Texas Southwest Medical Center, looking at dietary intervention and cardiovascular disease. So what we're really starting to see is vascular biologists starting to help us to understand the mechanism that connects together inflammation, endothelial dynamics, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and atherogenesis, and therefore possibly intervening with a program that deals with the reduction of inflammatory potential in a tissue-specific way will handle many diseases in terms of a preventive strategy. It goes back to the wall concept that we were discussing earlier about the polypill, that if we hit the right mechanisms, maybe many positive benefits will play out over decades of living. So this is the Walden Law hypothesis. Well, you know, when we start talking about agents that could initiate inflammation and could contribute to insulin resistance and could affect in the vascular system and have an adverse effect upon kidney function, leading maybe to increased risk to nephropathy and pressure control problems relating to hypertension and possibly even later stage renal failure, it leads us into a whole interesting series of questions, again, cutting across the environment and the modification that things in our environment have on our function. The place I want to focus our attention right now is this concept of glycation. Let's go back and just quickly review what I mean by glycation and how that relates to inflammation, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and a nephropathic injury leading to renal failure. As you probably recall, we measure in the plasma or blood in following a patient who has diabetes the ability for their diabetes to be controlled, an analyte called hemoglobin A1c, or glycosylated hemoglobin. Glycosylated hemoglobin is where the heme protein has undergone a non-enzymatic reaction with glucose in the blood to undergo what's called the Maillard reaction. That's M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D. The Maillard reaction is actually a reaction that was first described in food chemistry that I'll come back to discuss. It's a glycosylation reaction where the aldose form of a reducing sugar, like glucose, reacts with the lysyl amino group of an amino acid and a protein to produce a shifts base that then rearranges to form a stable addict that's called the Maillard product. That's a glycosylation product. Now, that's a bunch of chemistry, so let's cut it down here if we can to what you might think of in terms of a mental model that would be more understandable, and that's the crust of bread. I think you've heard me say this before. Glycosylation is to make crusty bread. When you take dough, which contains protein and sugar, and you cook it in the oven after you've yeast fermented it, what happens is that in the warm spot of the interface between the oven temperature, the oxygen in the oven, and the dough itself, you have this advanced reaction, which is a glycosylation reaction, where sugar is reacting with the amino groups of the protein to produce the shifts bases that become then the crust of bread. So glycosylation is in chemistry to form crusts or to form oxidation injured proteins, combination of lipids with sugar or protein with sugar. Now, that particular reaction, which makes a cosmetically attractive bread and also a different flavor in the crust than the dough of the bread, and you all know that, could also be used analogously to talk about what's going on within the plasma. You're having glucose react with proteins like plasma proteins to induce then these glycosylation reactions. If they occur randomly and they're not controlled by non-enzymatic control under the agency of the Maillard reaction, they then form crusty proteins floating in your blood. These are called advanced glycosylation end products, or AGEs. AGEs, as you probably recognize if we accumulated a lot of them, are associated with biological aging, A-G-I-N-G. So the accumulation of advanced glycosylation end products, or AGEs, is associated with biological aging in all animals that have been studied to date, including, obviously, humans. So we want to prevent the disadvantageous random glycosylation of our proteins and the formation of these AGEs. By the way, it's also been found that there are receptors on various cells, like immune cells, for these advanced glycosylation end products, and these are the receptors for AGEs, so what does that mean? RAGEs, right? That's RAGEs. So when you have a lot of AGE proteins, your body is enraged. Can you get the drift of what I'm saying? You have receptors for advanced glycosylated end products, that's RAGEs, that are activated by AGEs, and therefore a lot of crusty proteins in your body produces enraged physiology. I'm using that kind of metaphorically, by upregulating then inflammatory potentials, oxidative injury, mitochondrial effects, and an immune system that is now in an alarm reaction. Now, with that in mind, you might say, well, is there any connection then between eating glycosylated proteins and activation of your RAGEs, your receptors of advanced glycosylation end products? Because we've always assumed that when we eat things, they're broken down and they're metabolized by our digestive enzymes, and before they ever get absorbed across the brush border cells into the blood, they have been suitably detoxified and properly presented so that they don't have any disinformation still present in those molecules of food that might cause dysfunction. That's the presumption we have from our standard gastroenterology thinking. However, in terms of these dietary AGEs, the molecules that have come from cooking sugar-rich foods that are high in protein at high temperature, or carbohydrate-protein connections, those AGEs, those advanced glycosylation end products, or what we might call glycotoxins, to use the term advisedly, where you have glycosylation of protein producing a glycotoxin, those have been found recently to be absorbed into the blood to some small extent, which then means they could put a burden on the body's immunological system. This is a whole new aha about how individuals might have differential response to cooked foods that were foods that were cooked which were high in protein and high in sugar. Think, if you would, meringue, for instance. There's an interesting example where you got egg protein and sugar, right? And you cook it intentionally to produce that browning reaction. There is a huge amount of glycosylation. So now you eat that, you get a load of that. Now what does that do to your immune system? Interesting question, right? It's a new molecule. It's a foreign molecule that may incite your RAGEs to become enraged. That's the model. So now with that in mind, let's talk about the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Volume 94, going back to 1997, a paper that came out of the work and laboratories of Dr. Helen Blasara and her colleagues at the Laboratory of Diabetes and Aging in Manhasset, New York. And this is entitled Orally Absorbed Reactive Glycation Products, i.e. glycotoxins, an Environmental Risk Factor in Diabetic Nephropathy. Oh boy, the title alone kind of takes us down the path, doesn't it? Because what it says, just to summarize the paper without going through it in great detail, is that the renal excretion of orally absorbed AGEs is markedly suppressed in people who already have insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. It also demonstrates a daily influx of dietary AGEs, that these glycotoxins may constitute an added chronic risk factor for renal vascular injury, and that dietary restriction of AGE food intake may greatly reduce the burden of AGEs in diabetic patients and possibly improve their prognosis. I'm quoting directly from the paper. So cooked foods that are high in sugar and protein may in fact enhance the relative age-related reactions that are associated with these glycosylation end products. So in animal studies, if you restricted the exposure then to these aged proteins in the diet, would that have any effect on kidney aging? And the answer is yes. From animal studies, I'm now quoting from a series of papers, but one is the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology, Volume 11, page 1488 in the year 2000, in which they showed that restriction of dietary intake of these glycosylation products led to improved retention of kidney function in aged rats versus those that were fed intentionally certain amounts of AGE proteins in their diet. Very, very interesting. And again, they actually showed by a dose-response relationship how dietary ages could influence in an adverse way kidney function. Another interesting example is a paper, again, out of Dr. Blasara's group. Inflammatory mediators are induced by dietary glycotoxins, and this is a major risk factor for diabetic angiopathy. So they go on again to show that in diabetes, this environmental dietary ages promote inflammatory mediators leading to tissue injury, and that restriction of dietary ages can suppress their effects. So if we go to recent reviews on this topic, it's very interesting to see how this field is emerging. A couple of reviews that were published in 2001 and 2002 have kind of given us a sense of this field. One is entitled Advanced Glycosylation End Products, and this is found in Diabetologica, Volume 44, page 129. And this review talks about the fact that these advanced glycosylation end products are a complex heterogeneous group of compounds that have implicated in a variety of diabetes-related complications, ocular injury, neurologic injury, and nephropathic injury associated with the oxidative upregulation of the immune system. They also lead to what's called protein carbonylation, which is another factor that's associated with the immune reactions and oxidative stress that occurs during this upregulation of the immune system caused by exposure to ages. So when we looked at all this together, it seems that agents that are used for the treatment of advanced glycosylation end products would be very useful in reducing the injury of tissues in individuals who have metabolic syndrome, hyperinsulinemia. And what are those? Well, one class of substances are the aminoguanidines. They're probably the most well-studied of the pharmacological agents to reduce glycation, and these are the metformin-like compounds, and it's possible that one of the benefits of metformin, beyond that, obviously, of its glucose-regulating effect, is its anti-glycation effect. We also recognize that the natural substance carnosine is an anti-glycation agent as well, and that carnosine has been shown in a variety of animal studies to be very helpful when given in supplementary doses in the reduction of the combination of glucose with protein to form these AGEs, these advanced glycosylation end products. Clearly, when blood sugar is inappropriately controlled, when insulin regulation is disturbed, there is a very strong increasing risk to the formation of AGEs. And that then ties together with increased inflammatory potential, which ties together with increased cardiovascular risk, nephropathic risk, neurological injury, and ocular injury. So it's a part of a degenerative disease accumulative process. So rather than think about putting people on medications once they get to the endpoint of damage, possibly what they should be put on is an early stage protector against advanced glycosylation end products, which means a diet and lifestyle that reduce glycosylation. Now, from a clinical management perspective, this translates probably to most of you into something like lowering their glycosylated hemoglobin. Don't allow them to get into the upper limits of normal or above the upper limits of normal. Try to manage their glycosylated hemoglobins more in the 5 to 6% range, not in the 6% plus range. And try to use this as a marker over the life of the red cell, knowing you have about a 120-day life of a red cell, so you want to recognize that any change you make today, you may not observe significant changes in glycosylated hemoglobin for another 3 months, but you can use this as a marker for tracking some of these variables that associate diet and lifestyle with glycosylation and subsequently with inflammation and with hypertension and with metabolic syndrome. Again, it's a web of interacting variables, and we're really looking for a way to lower the incidence of later stage chronic complex disease requiring very cost and effective pharmacological intervention. Well, with that in mind, we might ask the question, what else could be approached that is an age-related problem from a similar strategy? And that takes us into a discussion about how these advanced glycosylation end products and other factors initiate brain injury. And so I think we should probably talk a moment about dementia and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and so-called neuroprotective therapy. So let's talk a little bit about protection of the brain. And of course, this is a very fascinating part of our functional medicine developing story because it was not but 10 years ago that the brain, once injured in the adult, was considered to be irreparable and that this was a one-way street. And if you lost neuronal reserve by injuring your neurons and causing apoptotic death prematurely, so be it, nothing to do later. Now the emerging model is that the brain can repair itself. This is pretty remarkable. And that the broken brain can be partly fixed. And so, you know, for most of the 100-year history of neuroscience, it really embraced the dogma that a mature adult's brain remains a stable, unchanging, computer-like machine with fixed memory and processing power, and that you lose brain cells and the story is gone, but you can't gain any new ones. So that's that kind of deterministic model. Well, now we're starting to see that there are stem cells that are present in the brain and can engage in the regeneration, admittedly maybe slowly and not to the same, obviously, reparative ability as the liver or the skin, but still do have an effect. And so neurologists are now moving to say, let's possibly engage in interventions that would help both to protect against the loss of neuronal function and would also help to support repair of the brain. So within the past 5 years, neuroscientists have discovered that the brain does indeed change throughout life, and such revision is a good thing. New cells and connections that we and others have documented through studies that have been done both at the cognitive level as well as the neuroscience level provide the capacity for the brain to manage the challenges that increase as we grow older, because we have all those experiences in life we have to continue to hold on to, plus all the new things to learn. The environment is continually changing, and our brain has that capacity. In fact, as you probably know, Martin Seligman, a wonderful experimental psychologist doing extraordinary work, showed that in older age individuals that were showing signs of presenile dementia that were in nursing homes, that when he and his colleagues went in and had them read adventure stories and various books and helped them to play games, that their IQ was seen to improve more than 12 points over the course of game playing, just by this old use-it-or-lose-it concept. That's functional medicine, right? That's the concept of improving functional reserve by waking up the genes that are kind of asleep and getting them back into a state of expression of function. So as a Scientific American series of papers indicate in their issue that appeared back in September 2003, there may be very significant ways that brain function can be improved by both protection and stimulation of function. Well, there may be, obviously, the discovery of natural agents that block the brain's destructive process, the apoptotic process, the neuronal suicide process. And these substances, as they're discovered, will then allow for the better delivery of what's called neuroprotective therapy. So we're going to be speaking about this concept of neuroprotective therapy. Now, the first time I used this term was more than 10 years ago when an article had appeared in The Lancet entitled Parkinson's Emerging Mechanism, authored by Dr. Clue. In this particular paper, you might recall, and we actually reviewed it in Functional Medicine Update at the time, he had discussed that by the time a person exhibits Parkinsonian-like symptoms, they've lost about 80% of the reserve capacity or function of the Niagara striatum, that their dopaminergic neurons are significantly compromised, about 80% of them are dead. And that's pretty late in the process to introduce any kind of neuroprotective therapy. So his concept was we needed to move way back earlier to the early signs of pre-Parkinsonism or pre-Alzheimer's and start introducing neuroprotective therapy. And of course, the question is, well, how do we identify that? I mean, what are the markers for pre-Parkinsonism or pre-Alzheimer's disease? And now we're starting to see through use of various CAT scanning technologies and SPECT scanning that maybe there are indications that occur well before pathologic injury, either by the loss of Niagara striatum or neurofibrillary tangle formation with Alzheimer's, that would help us to better understand how and when to intervene with neuroprotective therapy. For instance, the loss of smell in midlife is one of the risk factors that has been identified to be associated with Alzheimer's because of the connection between the nose and the neurosensory neurons and the brain, which is one of the few places where the brain is directly in contact with the outside environment, is through our ability for olfaction. So if a person starts losing their sense of smell, sense of taste, and, you know, you say, well, it's a zinc deficiency, but they don't respond to zinc, and they have this premature, really, dulling of their senses of smell and taste, then that may be an indication that one needs to ramp up their aggressive approach towards neuroprotective therapy in these individuals. And then, of course, the question is, what does neuroprotective therapy mean? And we're going to discuss that in just a moment. But I believe that these series of 4 to 5 articles that appeared back-to-back in Scientific American in September 2003 were really landmark papers to identify that the brain can repair itself, it is plastic, it is changing, it can learn as we grow older, and it can defend itself against agents. It's not just a computer sitting up there waiting to get hacked up on viruses and injured, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no repair people around to fix it. And so that leads then to the question of, can we ever think of developing a smart pill? Well, to go back with the Walden Law article earlier, in other words, would our poly pill that we've talked about or our poly program not only have impact on reducing the incidence and risk of cardiovascular disease by 80%, but would it also, because of the mechanisms of increasing risk to brain injury, also lower the risk to brain injury? In other words, would one treatment have a fit for many age-related diseases? A very interesting concept coming from a functional medicine perspective. And that's, of course, again, spoken to a little bit in this series of papers in Scientific American. The article I'm now quoting from is The Quest for a Smart Pill, How Can We Improve Memory and Cognitive Performance in Impaired Individuals, and Is There Something That Is a General Theme That Connects to Other Diseases of Aging? And, of course, the theme that seems to be emerging is this inflammation theme, because we recognize from epidemiological studies that people that were taking nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for osteoarthritis or low-dose aspirin for prevention of heart disease, that they had a much lower incidence, in fact, a 50% statistically lower incidence of Alzheimer's in an age-adjusted study. These have been published in a number of different journals. The most prominent probably is the one that appeared in the journal Neurology back in 1997. So there's this suggestion that anti-inflammation has a positive impact on the prevention of brain aging, brain injury. And so then you say, well, what goes on in the brain that could create inflammation? And then we recognize that a great portion of the brain's mass is the brain's immune system, the microglia. And the microglia, just like the immune system in our blood or the immune system in our liver called the Kupffer cells or the immune system in our gut called the GALT, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, all takes its messages from the environment to potentially upregulate inflammation. And when you upregulate inflammation in the brain, just like inflammation in the liver or inflammation in the intestines or inflammation in the blood, you increase oxidative stress, you have an adverse impact upon mitochondrial function, you then trigger cell signaling to create more likelihood for apoptotic cell death, you increase nitric oxide output, peroxynitrite, all the factors that we've been discussing in FMU for the many years. So that would, by the nature of the discussion, increase the risk to loss of organ reserve, which, because the brain cannot repair itself as quickly as, say, the liver, may then lead to compromised neuronal reserve and ultimately dementia. So this is a very complex, multifactorial process we're talking about. First of all the good neuroprotective therapy in the absence of any neurologic stimulation will still lead to degeneration. That's the use it or lose it. So if a person just has no reason for being, they have no biology of hope, they feel despair, they feel lonely, they feel disconnected, they feel no affirmation as an individual, no reason for living, no raison d'etre, then what's it going to do to the ability of their molecules of emotion to produce repair? It's going to lower them, and that's well recognized from many different neurological studies published in animals and suggested studies, epidemiological studies in humans. So again, stimulation, leading a life that has some sense of value, finding something that's exciting, that's worthy for your attention, that stimulates you intellectually. You've got to keep moving. Retirement doesn't mean death. That's the concept that comes out of this. And with all the aging baby boomers that are going to be thinking about where do they go with their minds and bodies after work when they complete their professional life, if they don't have something that continues to stimulate neuronal function, it is use it or lose it. This concept, I think, is a really interesting concept. And by the way, it's actually described in a beautiful article authored by Dr. Mark George in that same issue of Scientific American entitled Stimulating the Brain, Activating the Brain Circuitry with Various Functions That Will Then Enhance Cognition and Even Help Fight Fatigue. Well, let's, if we can, go from this kind of more mind-body association down to some of the other principles that are emerging from neuroscience that might, from a functional medicine perspective, deliver on the objective of protecting the reserve of our cognitive and emotional function over time. And in order to do this, I would want to mobilize in part a nutritional component, because there is starting to be seen that there are factors within our diet that will play important roles in this neuroprotection pathway that I've been describing. And that then goes back to bring back a term that you've heard me use several times, and that's nutrigenomics, the role that nutrition has on gene expression. As you recognize, what I'm really referring to is that no two people respond identically to the constitution or the constituency of their diet. And therefore, based on differing genomic uniquenesses, you may have differing sensitivities to environmental stimuli, different inflammatory potential, different oxidative stress potential, and different risk to neuronal injury. So nutrigenomics is not only looking at inflammatory disorders like arthritis, but it's also looking at the role that nutrition can play in the modulation of neural inflammatory disorders and neurodegenerative diseases. And we recognize that nutrigenomics implies both the role that macronutrients have, that's fat, protein, and carbohydrate, and the forms of fat, protein, and carbohydrate, and micronutrients, which include the vitamins and minerals, essential fatty acids, and conditionally essential phytonutrients. These could be things like plant-derived phenols or bioflavonoids, nucleic acids. It could also include things like the glucosinolates and the effect that they have from the cruciferous vegetables on detoxifying enzyme systems. It could also include things like substances that activate the synthesis in the body of coenzyme Q10 or taurine or carnitine, which also have positive impact on neurological function, or glutathione, intramitochondrial glutathione. So you'll notice that there may be a whole array of different types of nutrients, both macro and micronutrients, that can be very important in modulating gene expression and proteomic outcome and later metabolomic function in a tissue-specific way that could be harnessed to deliver neuroprotection. So that is kind of a strategy that this nutrigenomics model is focused on. Now, it's a long way from saying this in words to delivering in the clinic and in the individual because of the wide variety of difference from person to person and how we assess this and how we personalize the program to the individual needs. But at least for the first time that I can recall in my 30 years in this field, the tools are becoming available to actually ask and answer those questions. And we may see within the next few years gene screens that will allow us from a multi-panel screen to evaluate those inflammatory genes that are most tracked against neurodegeneration and then to mark their influence by different dietary influences on expression, how they would be cooled off. So we turn down the hot or the flames of neurodegenerative fire, if you think of inflammation as the brain on fire as it was modeled. So I want to again go back and just remind you of this nutrigenomic goal and strategy concept. By the way, this was described and we've reviewed it in the past, but just to put a marker in this wonderful paper that appeared in the Nature Reviews, Volume 4, page 315 in 2003, entitled Nutrigenomics Goals and Strategy, in which they actually describe specifically the use of various nutrients to modulate inflammatory signals in neurological function and in brain aging. Now, with that as a strategy and a mechanism for maybe asking and answering some of these questions, let me cut to the clinical takeaway. And that is this magnificent paper that appeared recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a volume 291, page 358 in 2004, entitled Neuroprotection in Parkinson's Disease, Mysteries, Myths, and Misconceptions. And you probably recall this article, but I want to bring out a couple of features of it because of its real important clinical relevance. They go on to say that Parkinson's disease, as an example of an age-related neurodegenerative disease, affects approximately 1 million people today in the United States, and its incidence is increasing as we're becoming an older age society. As you know, current therapies provide effective control of the symptoms, particularly in the early stages of the disease. This is like L-DOPA cinnamet therapy. But most patients develop motor complications with long-term treatment, and features develop such as postural instability, falling, and dementia, that are not adequately controlled with the existing medications, which then opens the opportunity for a different or augmented or accessory approach. Neuroprotective therapy, they then go on to say, might slow, stop, or even reverse disease progression, and that we need urgently to find a way of understanding what neuroprotective therapy for Parkinson's is and then deliver it more effectively. So then if we turn in this paper to the next page on neuroprotection trials, there is a figure one in the article that to me is a landmark because it is everything that we have spoken to and about and the whole foundation of our philosophy of functional medicine for the past 20 years that some of you have been listening to this monthly audio tape. Because it ties together genes, environment into a modification program focused in this specific case on the prevention of neurodegenerative disorders, i.e. Parkinson's. So let's go through the model that's on figure 1, page 359 of this paper. First of all, what is the emerging etiology for the neurodegeneration associated with what we call Parkinson's? Genetic factors, these we have identified as specific genes that may be associated with poor detoxification, like SNPs of glutathione transferase, or SNPs of catechol-methyltransferase, or SNPs of N-methyltransferase, or SNPs of the sulfation enzymes that are involved with detoxification of exogenous xenobiotics, these foreign compounds that can induce neurological injury. We know that from history and looking epidemiologically that Parkinson's disease is more common in individuals who are in workplace environments associated with the exposure to toxins, like farmers, for instance, and agricultural workers, and workers in the tanning industry and the paint industry and the glue industry have historically had higher incidence of Parkinson's. And those individuals in those work environments that may be most susceptible are those that have genetic susceptibilities to the inability to detoxify as effectively. And many papers have been published on this topic, including Rosemary Waring's classic papers that we've reviewed from England at Birmingham University Medical School in the Department of Neurology, showing that lower detoxification of sulfation, glucuronidation, and glutathione conjugation are associated with increased risk to neuro injury. So that's the genetic factor. Then you have the environmental factors, obviously. So what are the genes exposed to? What xenobiotics and what endogenous chemicals? So that leads to a gene-environment interaction that then presents itself as the etiology of Parkinson's. Now, and by the way, that then focuses a little bit on environmental medicine, because if you have the genes of high susceptibility, you don't want to put a person with those genes into a high-risk environment. So the environment needs to be tailored to the individual. This is environmental medicine, cleaning up the environment, pollution control, local ecos, environmental control, the home, air, water, mold, toxins, and so forth. Next, then, we go from etiology to pathogenesis. What are the four mechanisms that have been postulated as being the causative agents for the cellular injury and death in the nigra striatum associated with Parkinson's? And if you hear these four, you'll say, boy, those sound familiar. That sounds like things I've heard in Functional Medicine Update for nigh on 20 years. They include oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction, excitotoxicity, this is the NMDA receptor activations and the John Olney hypothesis of endogenous excitotoxicity, and lastly, the fourth component is inflammation. Now, I would say, and I'm sure you would agree, having been a student of this field for some time, that all four of those are interrelated. They're not independent etiological processes. Oxidative stress is interrelated with mitochondrial dysfunction, which is interrelated with inflammation, which is related to excitotoxicity. So these do not stand as independent contributors, but rather they have crosstalk and messenger molecules that share pathways throughout this process. So oxidative stress, how do we approach that? Now I'm quoting still from the same article. What would we do to implement neuroprotective therapy by lowering oxidative stress? And here they talk about antioxidant intervention, vitamin E, vitamin C, various antioxidants, iron chelators preventing free iron from being available in the nervous system that then induces free radical oxidative injury through dismutation of superoxide. So you basically then enhance the redox potential of the brain, reduction oxidation potential, by building reducing power or reducing buffering capacity. If I can use that term of buffering that we often use with blood buffer, with pH, we can also consider redox buffering by enhancing these antioxidants. Next is the mitochondrial dysfunction area. What do you do for improving mitochondrial function? Here they talk about bioenergetic agents. And what are the examples that they give? Coenzyme Q10, lipoic acid, N-acetylcarnitine. These are agents that enhance then the control of electron transport and mitochondrial function and lower than oxidative leakage out of the mitochondria by mitochondrial uncoupling. So here we see some very interesting examples of first intervening with antioxidants. This might even include things like N-acetylcysteine to enhance glutathione synthesis, and then bioenergetic agents, coenzyme Q10, lipoic acid, and the like. And next is excitotoxicity. They talk about lowering the activity or activation of the NMDA receptors. There's some new drugs that are being explored and will become available on the market soon that are anti-glutaminergic agents that will lower the NMDA activity, stimulation of the receptor, but we also know that there are dietary variables that will lower neuroexocytotoxicity. A clean diet, a diet that's lower in food chemicals, a diet that is more basic in its hypoallergenicity can have a salutary effect on lowering neuroexocytotoxicity. Also, less exposure to neuroexcitants like mercury or lead or cadmium can have a positive role as well. So environmental factors, dietary factors to lower excitotoxicity. And then lastly, of course, inflammation. How do you lower inflammation? Well, anti-inflammatory. So we talk about down-regulating NF-kappa B's expression, managing and controlling COX cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase activities, and trying to restore proper Th1 and Th2 balance in the immune system. So anti-inflammatories that might have important roles in regulating the expression of NF-kappa B, in other words, liberating NF-kappa B from its inhibitor kappa B in the cytosol so it then becomes available to the nuclear genome, causing expression patterns to change. So what you want to do is stabilize the I-kappa B, NF-kappa B complex and lower NF-kappa B activity. So these are all very important things that also relate to diet and lifestyle because we've talked about natural substances that modulate this inflammation potential. There are a whole range of different dietary spices and phytochemicals that we now know have anti-inflammatory capability. How about the omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA, and the role that they have on some of these cyclooxygenase pathways. So you'll notice that what is emerging from this JAMA discussion about neuroprotection and Parkinson's is a model that sounds very functional medicine in its approach. Evaluating antecedents, which they call genetic factors, looking at triggers, which they call environmental factors, and then the interaction of triggers with antecedents to give this gene-environment interaction, then looking at the mediators that come out of oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction, excitotoxicity, and inflammation, and modulating those using differential approaches based upon diet, lifestyle, and where necessary pharmaceutical intervention. And then that then ultimately results in improved protein handling, lowered loss of neuronal reserve, and lowered apoptotic cell death, which leads to obviously what Dr. Fries said, which is loss of organ reserve and ultimately increased dysfunction. So I think that this article in JAMA on neuroprotection and Parkinson's is a model for so many things that we have talked about in functional medicine and talk also in part to the polypill concept of reducing age-related complex chronic diseases by 80% by modulating pathways. Now, just to take this to the next level, you might ask, are there any papers that have been published that would document the role that these nutritional factors have in mitochondrial disorders or neurodegeneration, or is this all speculation? And there obviously is quite a large bibliography. I'll just touch upon a couple that I think are interesting. Recently in the Journal of American Dietetic Association, volume 103, page 1029 in 2003, a paper was published entitled Nutritional Cofactor Treatment in Mitochondrial Disorders, in which it is shown that one of the most well-accepted ways of approaching the management of mitochondrial disorders is through the augmentation of specific nutrients that are there to restore proper mitochondrial oxidative function. So they go on to say in this article that metabolic therapies have been reported to produce positive effects on mitochondrial degenerative disorders, which include coenzyme Q10, ascorbic acid, vitamin E, lipoic acid, increased levels of riboflavin, vitamin B2, niacin and thiamine, vitamin K, creatine, and carnitine, and that a review of these supplements in mitochondrial disorders unfolds quite a large bibliography of supporting documents. In fact, in this article alone, there are over 80 citations for the use of these various nutrients that I just mentioned in the treatment of mitochondrial disorders. Now, generally, they're talking about inborn errors of mitochondrial dysfunction. But as we know, there are induced injuries to mitochondria in the somatic cells that we've been talking about through oxidative stress and inflammatory upregulation and mitochondrial uncoupling. And so it's not just inborn errors, but it's maybe even the more mild induced mitochondrial injuries where these particular interventions can prove useful. Coenzyme Q10, riboflavin, vitamin E, lipoic acid, N-acetyl-carnitine, N-acetyl-cysteine, vitamin K, creatine, all interesting parts of this emerging story. We know that coenzyme Q10 intake elevates mitochondrial and tissue levels of coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E in animals, and therefore lowers protein carbonylation and glycation reactions as well. This is work that's been shown by Dr. Sohal and his colleagues at the University of Southern California recently. So you get benefits not only in the mitochondria themselves, but also it has effects on plasma reduction of oxidative injury. We know that if there is mitochondrial injury due to these oxidative stress reactions, that can modify cognition and increase what we call age-related dementia in a variety of control studies in animals. There's a very nice paper that was recently published in Nature Genetics, volume 35, page 65 in 2003, looking at how mitochondrial DNA injuries can modify cognition and produce then dysfunction at what we would call an intelligence level in the animal. Now, that leads us to the question, obviously, of what nutrient has been found maybe to be most useful for the protection of these mitochondrial processes that are so important for the maintenance of neuronal energy production and neuronal function. They control, ultimately, the production of neurotransmitters, neuromodulators, and may have effect upon mood, mind, memory, and behavior in a very significant way. And that's obviously a question that is still being rapidly and vigorously debated at the laboratory and clinical level, but one that I want to focus on that's beyond the obvious, which is coenzyme Q10, is vitamin E, because the vitamin E story that's emerging, I think, is quite fascinating. So I hope you'll bear with me here as I give you maybe a little bit more information than you ever wanted to know about vitamin E, but I think it's a useful story as to how we're evolving our understanding in this whole area of neuroprotective and health protective agents. Vitamin E, as you probably know, was first discovered and was given the name tocopherol, which is the Greek words put together to give birth, because it was found at the University of California at Berkeley back in the 1930s to be a substance that, or a family of substances that were derived from vegetable oil that when you took them out of this vegetable oil and fed it to animals, that the animal was unable to have any live births. In rats, they have a very convenient way of managing this. They resorb their fetuses. They don't miscarry. They just have resorption of the fetus. So in the absence of including in the diet this unusual fat-soluble factor of substances, they would undergo infertility, fetal resorption. By putting the substances back in the diet, they would have normal offspring, normal fertility. So because of that, vitamin E got the reputation as being a fertility vitamin, which then got a kind of a sexual connotation, right? You might, if those of you that have been around since the 50s and 60s might recall, the early lore about vitamin E was it was an aphrodisiac and that it was good for sexual vitality. And this really was misappropriated out of the work on its ability to prevent fetal resorption in animals and produce proper fertility and proper litters. Since then, vitamin E obviously has undergone much more discussion and discovery. It's recognized to be a member of different molecules in the family of what are called the tocopherols. And it can be broken down into several different types of tocopherols based on the methylation patterns of the chromane ring, which is part of the structure of the vitamin E molecule. And so it could be considered an alpha, a beta, a gamma, or a delta tocopherol. And then there are some derivatives of vitamin E that have unsaturated linkages in what are called the phytyl, P-H-Y-T-Y-L, side chain of the vitamin E molecule, which then makes them into what we call tocotrienol. So you might have alpha, beta, gamma, or delta tocotrienols. So it's a whole family of differing members that share similar chemical structure but may have differing function at the physiological level. Different plant oils or plant foods, which is where you derive vitamin E, have different dispositions or ratios of the alpha, beta, gamma, and delta tocopherols and the tocotrienols. So depending on what plant oil you extract the vitamin E from, you may have differing amounts of these different family members. Now, with that in mind, you might ask, well, what has been considered the most active form of vitamin E? And if you look at the literature over the past 50 years, it'll tell you that the D-alpha tocopherol, the natural form of vitamin E in the D-alpha form, is the most active. And it has something like 1.39 international units of activity per milligram, as contrasted to the synthetic vitamin E, the DL-alpha tocopherol, that has 1 unit per milligram. So it's about 30 to 40% more active per milligram, this natural form of D-alpha tocopherol. Now, the question you're going to ask is, well, how did that activity get analyzed? I mean, what was the biomarker that was used for determining its higher activity? Why is the alpha form more active than the beta, the gamma, or the delta? And that's a very fascinating part of the story, and let me quickly tell you, in developing the bioassay for it, the best way of determining its activity in animals was to look at its ability to prevent rat fetal resorption. And it was found that the most active form of vitamin E to prevent rat fetal resorption was the alpha form. And so it was given the highest potency, 1.39 international units of activity per milligram. Now, the obvious question you might ask is, how many people take vitamin E to prevent rat fetal resorption? And the trivial answer is not many people I know do. So they take it for other reasons, cardioprotection, immunological effects, chondrial defense, and all these other things, neuroprotection. And does that relate directly to vitamin E's effect on the prevention of rat fetal resorption? And that has been the big controversy, because for years we've assumed that the most active for the prevention of rat fetal resorption, the alpha form, was also the most active form for the prevention of all these other diseases in humans. Well, now with that in mind, let's look at what's emerged the last few years. First of all, it's been found that the most common form of vitamin E in plant food oils is not alpha, but it's gamma. And therefore, the manufacturers of vitamin E often intentionally converted gamma to alpha to make it into a, quote, more active formulation, meaning higher IUs per milligram or better in preventing rat fetal resorption. And so we intentionally moved gammas to become alphas. But the major form in the diet is gamma tocopherol if you eat a natural diet. So we've been eating mostly gammas if you're a vegetarian, but we've been supplementing mostly with alphas. I hope you understand the difference there. By the way, this comes from a paper that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 74, page 714 in 2001, that talks about gamma tocopherol being the major form of vitamin E in the U.S. diet. Then, if we looked at the role that the gamma tocopherols have as contrasted to alpha tocopherol, in the variety of functional opportunities for vitamin E to participate in physiological function beyond that of prevention of rat fetal resorption, we find that it has a very dramatic series of effects that do not appear to be as well shared with the alpha form, meaning there may be some benefits to gamma tocopherol in human physiology that we have been missing for the last 10 years. Now, I wanted to stop parenthetically and say I want to give myself a little bit of credit for this, because in 1978, I spoke at an international vitamin E conference, and I raised the parenthetical question, not knowing really what I was saying at the time, only that we had been doing vitamin E research since 1971. I raised the question, could it be possible that the major food form of vitamin E, gamma tocopherol, had hitherto unexplained physiological effects, and maybe we were putting our eggs in the wrong basket, always focusing on alpha? And that actually ended up in an article and proceedings of that symposium, which I presented in England back in the late 70s. Now, since then, many other people have gotten very interested in the gamma tocopherol story and started to demonstrate that, lo and behold, it has a very profound influence on cytoprotection that is greater than that of alpha against certain free radical oxidants. And by the way, this is described in a very nice book on vitamin E that has a chapter entitled Beyond Alpha Tocopherol, the Role of Other Tocopherols and Tocotrienols in Cell Signal Transduction, Platelet Adhesion, and so forth, that appeared back in the year 2002. So is gamma tocopherol the new vitamin E? Question mark, asks Merritt Traber and her colleague in a recent paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 77, page 530 in 2003. And obviously the answer is no, it's not the new tocopherol. It's been around since time immemorial, but we are now reviewing its activity in a different way than ever before. And it may be the preferable form of vitamin E to prevent nitrosation reactions and protect against peroxynitrite, which is a result of immune upregulation and inflammation. It may be the preferable effect to defend against endothelial arterial injury. So maybe gamma tocopherol deserves a lot more attention in terms of its potency as it relates to physiological protection against age-related chronic diseases than does the alpha form. Now, this is seen in a variety of different papers. For instance, recently in the FASIP journal, volume 17 in 2003 and page 816, A very nice paper was authored by Bruce Ames and his colleague at the Division of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, University of California, in which they talk about gamma tocopherol, but not alpha tocopherol, decreasing pro-inflammatory eicosanoids. These are the cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase-derived eicosanoids, and therefore in reducing inflammation damage in animals when given against a control, which is the alpha tocopherol supplement in animals. So they use corn oil, alpha tocopherol supplemented corn oil, and gamma tocopherol supplemented oil, and they showed that the gamma on a mole-to-mole ratio on an equivalency basis had a much better ability to lower leukotriene B4 and cyclooxygenase-mediated eicosanoids, the two series prostaglandins, which are pro-inflammatory, pro-platelet adhesive, and pro-cell proliferative. So gamma tocopherol appeared in these studies, again, when emphasized in animals, to be preferable in these functions. In another paper that was authored by Ames and his colleagues, it appeared in the Free Radical Biology and Medicine Journal, Volume 33, page 1534, they talk about gamma tocopherol supplementation inhibiting both protein nitration and ascorbate oxidation in animals that had been promoted to have inflammation, suggesting that the gamma tocopherol has preferable anti-inflammatory effects. Gamma tocopherol, also in contrast to alpha tocopherol, may directly inhibit cyclooxygenase activity in macrophages, which is one of the most important cell types that's involved with the production of inflammatory mediators in circulation. This was a result of a Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences paper that appeared, Volume 97, back in the year 2000. We now recognize that the combination of the alpha, beta, gamma, and delta tocopherols when studied in humans was able to show enhanced function on endothelial nitric oxide synthase, regulation of superoxide dismutase, and protein kinase C activities in leukocytes of human subjects when supplemented with the mixed tocopherols. These were 64 subjects randomized into three groups, given either alpha tocopherol, mixed tocopherols, or controls, and saw a much more salutary effect on antioxidant activities when the mixed tocopherols were used. This is work published in Nutrition Research, Volume 22, page 1253 in 2002. And we know that mixed tocopherol preparations were found superior to alpha tocopherol against hypoxic reoxygenation-induced oxidative injury. This was Biochemical and Biophysical Research Communications, Volume 291, page 349 in 2002. So I think you can see where I'm going with this is a fairly broad body of literature indicating that in the vitamin E family, working with coenzyme Q10 and lipoic acid, the gamma tocopherol appears to have a preferential effect in helping to lower oxidative injury, nitric oxide inflammatory effects, peroxynitrite, nitrosation reactions, and may then serve as a better protective against dysfunction, including neuroprotection. Obviously, much more to learn and much more to say about this, but I think that we can say that the Walden Law article on reduction of age-related chronic disease in the way of cardiovascular by a polypill has opened the door for us to really look from a functional medicine perspective at what is the more cost-effective medicine and how can we deliver the biology of hope to our patients. Thanks very much.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.